You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 30th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Well met.
Well met, Evan.
Well met, young man.
We actually have two interviews this week.
That's so many interviews.
Wow. It's crazy.
It'll be worth it, though.
Reese Morgan's going to join us a little bit later to talk about the Brzezinski Cancer Clinic. And then James Randi's going to be paying a visit with us a little bit later in the show.
But we love that guy.
We do. We love that
guy. Both those guys.
Both of them.
One's very old, one's very young.
Combined, they're 100 years old.
They are. That's funny. Randi is probably our oldest guest, and Reese is probably our youngest guest.
We've got an average of two middle-aged guys.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, that's right. All right, Evan, tell us about December 3rd, 1872.
Assyriologist George Smith uttered the following words, and I quote, "A short time back, I discovered among the Assyrian tablets in the British Museum an account of the flood, which, under the advice of our president, I now bring before the Society." And thus began Smith's address to the Society of Biblical Archaeology in London, England, which included a reading from the cuneiform tablets of the Chaldean account of the deluge. And by the deluge, Smith, of course, means the flood. And by the flood, Smith, of course, means the great flood, the one that made Noah
by the great flood
ark world famous.
Right. Right. So the question is, first of all, I have one question for you, Evan. What is the capital of Assyria?
Capital of Assyria, huh? Damascus.
So you see, you have to know the answer to this question in case you're ever stuck at a bridge and some old guy is asking you that question. It's actually a very complicated answer because there were four capitals of Assyria over different points in history. One of them was Nineveh. None of them were Damascus, by the way, so you would be ejected into the pit of despair. Where'd you get ejected into when you didn't know?
Yeah, but you see, I would have argued that I didn't hear him correctly. I thought he said Syria, so I would have been correct on those terms.
Yes, there you
but
go.
In any case.
Anyway, the other question is, did legends of creation and the flood predate the Jewish creation myths? And in other words, did these come from other cultures to the Old Testament, or was this all originate with the traditions that led to the Old Testament and spread to these other cultures, Babylonia and Assyria?
What came first, the Bible or the flood?
So the tablets that you're talking about definitely show that there was a great antiquity to these legends in Assyria and Babylonia, but not pre-contact with the Jews. So,
well, they know that these tablets were created 30 century BC, mm-hmm. right, which is roughly 5,000 years ago from now. And, you know, Jewish Old Testament history is kind of roughly about the same. I think it goes, well, you know, the Jewish calendar is in the 5700s right now. So we're, roughly 6,000 years of Jewish history.
So the distilled version of these stories and legends that we get in the Old Testament or in any one source is, you can't think of it as there was just one story that was developed in one culture at one time. It actually was multiple traditions from multiple cultures that evolved over time and intermingled and were swapped back and forth, you know?
But at the time, this all caused a big sensation, as you can imagine, back in the 1872. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Bob, you're going to tell us about how to spot digital picture fraud.
Yeah, this was pretty interesting. Scientists in the U.S. have created a new powerful software tool for determining the extent of manipulation of digital images. This new tool can not only be used for seeing things like if a model or a celebrity is not maybe as lean or blemish-free as they might appear on a magazine cover, but it can also be used, and this I found most interesting, to address a growing concern in the scientific community, which is the unnecessary or even deceitful manipulation of scientific images, which is actually a much bigger problem than I thought it was. This analysis tool was created by Haney Farid and his colleagues at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Now, the concerns of image manipulation in advertising, it's not just like, you know, this morbid curiosity about celebrities misrepresenting themselves. I mean, it can be fun to see, you know, the real picture and the manipulated picture, kind of like, you know, driving past a car wreck, like, oh my God, look what they did to that picture. But there's a real concern that many eating disorders can be triggered by all these unrealistic advertisements that we're bombarded with every day. So it's become so bad that many countries in Europe are actually considering legislation that would require notification in the image or near the image that there has been some manipulation. But this actually isn't the ideal solution, because if you just had a little sentence that said this image has been manipulated or whatever, you don't know the extent of the manipulation. You can't really compare an image that's been cropped or color corrected, which is perfectly legitimate in pretty much every case. You can't really compare them to images of a model with a bizarrely small waist. It really isn't fair to compare them. You need something that's a little bit more specific. And this is exactly what Fareed did. He created a scale from 1 to 5 to represent how much the image has been altered, and specifically where as well. So I also like how these scientists use real people to help fine-tune his algorithms, because we all know that human pattern recognition is still supreme. Although there's been lots of advances in software doing pattern recognition, still humans are just pretty much at the pinnacle of that ability for now anyway. So he took about, I think it was like 350 volunteers, or 50, depending on your source. It must have been a typo or something. But he had these people rank how different a series of paired images were. And a 1, if you gave them a rank of 1, it meant that the pair was very similar, and all the way to 5, which meant that the pair was very different. And then he took these results and he plugged them into his machine learning software, and he was able eventually to really closely match the pattern recognition skills of the people after he would do testing, after his software was updated. He ran the test again, and there was a pretty decent match between the software and I guess other volunteers. So the really cool thing is that the results are nicely granular, which is pretty much the essence of this breakthrough. You could see really specific areas of the body and face that are color-coded, representing, you know, a 1 would be red and a 5 would be green or whatever, to show how manipulated that part, that specific part of the image is. But the downsides, though, as of now anyway, is that the accuracy is only about 80%, which, I mean, 80% is nice, but I thought it would be a little bit higher than that based on what I was reading beforehand. But I'm sure that will improve, and still 80% is pretty good. Also, it's not optimized for images of things that are not people. It's specifically set up for people. However, it shouldn't take too much tweaking, they say anyway, to address the growing concern of scientific fraud. And like I said before, I found this really interesting. I really wasn't aware that this was a big problem. Apparently, it's so bad that Fareed describes it as extremely disturbing. As with advertising, there's a range of manipulation. Often, scientists just want better-looking images, which is understandable. You know, they remove things like unanticipated and inconsequential flaws. Sometimes, though, they adjust images in such a way that they can actually skew the results of their experiments, which is obviously pretty unethical and should be dealt with fairly harshly.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I bet you a lot of it is inadvertent, in that, because who takes a raw image, 100% raw, and publishes it or uses it without any alteration whatsoever? You're always going to be doing some kind of tweaking to make the picture more viewable, or to make the details more visible,
more prevalent.
To crop it to get rid of extraneous, you know, data or extraneous parts of the image.
That's the beauty. That's the beauty of this, because it's, you know, the cropping, the color correcting, and the minor blemishes and things. You can kind of get an idea of where they were, but it can also point out significant structural changes to things that are in the image. So that's the power of this: is that it's very subtle.
One solution is just to require the transparency.
The
here's the raw images, and here's the prettified one, so that you could see the data.
And then I was thinking that
people could decide if you are highlighting the data or manufacturing the data by the manipulation that you're doing.
That seems like a no-brainer to me. Yeah, that's such an easy solution.
You guys familiar with the Curiosity mission to Mars?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's awesome.
Yeah. So this successfully launched, and it's on its way to Mars. This is a NASA project. It's a rover that will hopefully be landing successfully on Mars. And the primary mission of this rover is to detect for conditions that are suitable for life.
This thing is you know, the Mac Daddy of all rovers.
Yeah.
I mean, it is it's huge compared to our other rovers. Has a ton more scientific laboratories built into it. It's going to be doing things that, you know, we could never do on site before, which mm-hmm. is pretty damn cool. And just to take a look at it, you know, I recommend taking a quick second to look at the cool pictures of it. It really does look pretty interesting and very sci-fi-esque, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's cool. It should be landing August 6th, 2012. So it's going to take about 9 months to get to Mars.
What takes so long? Where's the warp drive?
Well, yeah, there's no light, no people on board, right? It's just a probe, so there's no real rush. So they can design a trajectory that's efficient, doesn't have to get there very, very quickly.
I'm sorry, I'm in a rush for knowledge.
Right?
Yeah, but what's the quickest I've heard that with our current types of rockets, the quickest we could really get to Mars would be about 3 months.
Yeah, but doesn't the time of year, you know, our Earth's relative position to Mars have a big factor in how long it takes
Jay,
to get there?
Well, yeah, Jay, that's optimizing launch time for when the Earth and Mars are relative to each other, so that the trajectory to Mars will be the shortest.
That's optimized. Blah blah blah. I mean, I'm just, you know, it's a good point to bring up. I don't think a lot of people know that.
But of course they're going to do that. That's what the quote unquote launch window is.
Of course, yeah.
But it's even assuming that, it's going to be months to get to Mars. So 9 months, yeah, it's longer than the shortest possible time to get to Mars with current rockets, but it's not that much more.
They say the mission will last about 2 years once it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that rushing would have a benefit for the technology on board? I mean, the difference between 3 months and 9 months, I mean, that's 6 months for a lot of really high-tech equipment to go on the fritz.
Get radiated.
Yeah, or, you know, any number of mishaps could happen.
Yeah. I'm sure the guys at NASA took all that into consideration in terms of the expense and safety of the mission.
And the metric system and everything
else. Right. The whole metric
mix-up.
Oh, my God.
I'm just not looking forward to the inevitable abandonment of this rover. I mean, losing the last one on Mars was really sad.
Yeah.
Like he had a little Twitter account, and I cried.
Uh-huh.
We got a lot of mileage out of him, though.
Yeah, are you kidding me? I was very proud of how well they did on that. It was very impressive how long it lasted and how much they actually...
I blame Wally.
You could tweet from Mars. What an interesting concept. We should all tweet as life forms in the oceans of Europa.
But it will be equipped to identify organic compounds, carbon-rich compounds. So that would go a long way to suggesting that there could still be, or at least used to be, life on Mars.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll definitely follow along with this mission. I imagine we'll be talking about it next August.
Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe we'll get someone from the team.
Yeah, we'll try to get somebody from NASA to talk to us about it. Rebecca, tell us about how creationists have penetrated all the way north into New Hampshire.
Yeah, normally when we talk about creationism seeping into politics or into schools, it's usually in the South. But
Georgia, Texas.
Texas, yeah, is a big one.
Kansas.
But the creationists have not limited themselves to that region. They have, in fact, apparently done a pretty good job of infiltrating New Hampshire, of all places. There was, just in this past week, there was a bill that would have let parents object to any school course materials and force the school to use alternatives to teach their child. It was a pretty generic bill, apparently, and it was the lack of specifics that was worrisome enough for enough representatives to kill it. The House voted 244 to 130 in favor of overriding the veto, but luckily that was short of what they needed, which was 2/3 of the total number of representatives. So, but that's a ridiculous number of House representatives, 244, who were in support of this bill. This is part of the creationist plan to sort of back away from, for instance, teaching, like straight up asking science teachers to teach creationism, things like that. They've resorted to doing these really sneaky little tactics that allow them to get what they call the thin end of their wedge in. So what this bill would have done is allow any parent to say to a school, the teaching of evolution goes against my child's religion. Therefore, you must provide my child with an alternative that will still allow the child to meet state standards, which is kind of impossible, I think. I hope it's impossible to meet standards by missing out on teaching evolution, since it's such an important part of our scientific understanding. But alas, that's what would have happened. So it's very good that the governor of New Hampshire, John Lynch, vetoed the bill. And it's good that just enough House representatives agreed with the veto to kill it. But in case you think that that's all there was to worry about, back in June, the National Center for Science Education, run by our good friend Eugenie Scott, pointed out that there are several anti-evolution bills that are on the horizon for New Hampshire. There, New Hampshire has this weird thing where it's actually, I think it's unique, in which they have to give an early warning about bills that representatives are planning to submit. And so there are two that are drafted for the 2012 legislative session. One which would require the teaching of evolution in public schools as a theory, and a second which would require instruction in intelligent design in the public schools. That second one, I'm hoping, is just ridiculous enough to die immediately. But the first one is one of those sneaky things. Well, you know, they call it a theory, so it should be okay to say it's just a theory, blah, blah, blah. We don't know what the actual language in those bills is going to be until they are submitted. So we're just going to have to wait and see in the 2012 session. So those of you who live in New Hampshire, you might want to contact your representatives and find out how they feel about these topics. The representatives who are submitting those bills that I just mentioned are Jerry Bergevin and Gary Hopper. But even if those aren't your representatives, you should contact yours and let them know that this is not the sort of thing that they should be supporting.
But in the past, even really innocuous things like that, like teaching the other side or teaching the controversy or just, you know, explaining that this is just a theory, when it singles out evolution, it's been struck down for that reason, that, you know, the religious agenda is clear, because why would you single out evolution among all the scientific theories that are taught in the classroom? So they tried to get more sly by throwing a bunch of other theories in there too, as if,
yeah,
you know, that to disguise their intentions, but it doesn't sound like they're even, you know, wise enough to do that in this case.
Well, yeah, and that's what ended up killing this recent bill. The governor pointed out that the problem with the bill was that it didn't clearly lay out which subjects would be able to be objected to. And he pointed out that that would be incredibly disruptive in classrooms to have, because it's so general, to have any parent being able to object to absolutely anything. A good friend of mine's a seventh grade science teacher who does a whole part of the semester is focused on critical thinking. And as part of that, he uses an Ouija board. And every year there are parents who object to it and ask to pull their children out of the class. And it's this huge to-do because, you know, it's Satan. Because Satan is, you know, being called upon. And
along with Harry Potter and yoga.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yoga.
No, the Catholic Church just announced that yoga is evil.
Because, really?
Because it encourages people to be Buddhist.
Wow.
Oh,
that's amazing.
Sinners, all of them.
Yeah. So I support parents who want to be involved in their child's education and want to be actively involved in that education. But when we give parents the ability to have complete control over what their kid is learning, it can actually be very disruptive and damaging.
Well, saying complete control over the public education process. You could teach your kids whatever you want at home.
So we're not objecting to that.
Yeah, it's just you can't have that many individuals all imposing their own personal beliefs and ideas onto, you know, the public school system, because it's just not practical. And it's just going to cause a lot of mischief. Well, Evan, tell us about why Scorpios may be finding it harder to find work in China.
That's because this particular Chinese firm doesn't want them to work for them.
Because they're assholes.
Because they tend to be yucky people, according to their English, according to their signs and translations and horoscopes. So from United Press International, we have this. Chinese firm doesn't want Scorpios or Virgos. An English language training company in China is drawing criticism for job postings stating Scorpios and Virgos need not apply. So the company was not named in the article that this report initially appeared in, but they will not accept applications from potential teachers and clerks born under certain zodiac signs. The posting reads, and I quote, "We don't want Scorpios or Virgos, and Capricorns, Pisces, and Libras will be prioritized."
Mm-hmm.
So they're not only discriminating against some people born under a sign, they are more likely to hire people born under these other signs.
Mm-hmm. Which is discrimination. I mean, I don't know what the rules are in China.
I mean, I wonder if it's bad enough that there's a market for fake IDs that just change your month of birth.
There is now.
Or if they should have a special astrology court where you go to argue that you weren't really born under that sign or you're on a cusp or something.
But this is China. Shouldn't they be worried about people like born under the year of the cock or something?
Yeah, they can't.
Hey, don't knock that.
Don't knock the cock, Steve.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on, Steve.
Well, it's not unique to this one company. If you look back a little bit to 2006, there's another headline. China company will only hire year of the dog job candidates.
Oh, there you go.
So how often do these things cycle through?
It's 12 years, right?
It's a 12-year cycle on the Chinese zodiac. But, you know, the point is it is discrimination.
The point is it's stupid.
It is.
Well, when
stupid.
You put it that way, yeah.
And how about, as long as we're in that part of the world, you know, Japan. They will hire people based on blood type.
Yeah, that's their astrology.
Blood typing. That's their version of it.
What's your blood type?
Yeah, it's still always disheartening to hear about things like that. It's still going on in the world. But let's move on. Let's soldier on. Jay, we're going to end our news items segment on something totally cool, like a jetpack.
Yeah, this is
please tell me
awesome
it's real
jetpack.
And affordable.
Yeah, Bob, you know this guy. You know the story.
Probably.
This is just another chapter in the coolness and how badass this guy actually is. Now, I'm talking about Mr. Badass himself, Yves Rossi, the 51-year-old Swiss inventor, and he's also known as the Jetman, which I didn't know about him before, but I just read that. And he recently flew in formation with two L-39C Albatross jets from the Breitling jet team. And I watched a video of this. What he does is he straps his 3-meter carbon fiber like jet wing to his back, so he can easily walk around with this thing. I don't know how heavy it is. I'd imagine that it's not that light because he's got four small jet engines that are connected to this thing. And he walks up onto the outside rail of a helicopter. They go up to altitude. He jumps off the helicopter. He is essentially free fall / gliding at that point. And then he turns on the jets and, you know, he gets altitude. You see him like he's not pointing down and all of a sudden he's up and he's going for it. So in the video, he does all that, and then he like gets in formation with these two completely awesome jets. He just rides along with them for a while, and then they
like
show
Iron
a
Man.
Shot.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yep. I was like, that's Iron Man. Yeah.
And they had a bunch of different angles of him doing it, and it just looks awesome from every which way you could see it. And then he had a veer away, and then immediately pulled the chute, and he has like one of those really big... Not the typical round chutes, but the kind that you can steer, you know, the ones that are more...
Yeah, the rectangular ones.
Rectangular ones. And then, like, he just lands, like, da-da-da, you know, just kind of tiptoes down.
So it can't be that heavy if you could land in a parachute wearing it.
It's true.
Yep, and he didn't fall to the ground.
I think if I remember correctly, it's 50-plus kilograms.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
It's really light.
So he had, just to remind our listeners, he's had previous missions where he flew this jetpack. He did a, in 2008, he rode across the channel from France to England, which only took 9 minutes and 7 seconds. And he was going about 190 miles per hour on that flight. In 2010, he did a loop-de-loop around a hot air balloon, which is really cool. And then in 2011, he flew across the Grand Canyon. The new very interesting tidbit of information I found while reading up on him again is that now he's working on a prototype wing that's going to allow him to actually take off from the ground.
Oh.
Yeah, that'd be the next step.
And it's supposed to be smaller, and it's supposed to be much more aerodynamic, so apparently he'll be able to be doing more tricks and whatnot with it and everything. Now, I'm thinking about this, and I'm going, all right, so this guy, he was a test pilot. This is his hobby and everything, but I'm wondering if there's other reasons why they're developing this technology. And then I'm thinking, well, okay, well, who would buy it? The military would probably buy this, of course. Then I thought, how cool would it be to see like 24 guys flying in formation in these things? I don't know how useful it would be because the fuel is only lasts, I think, 8 or 9 minutes at this point. You know, but they could probably increase that or whatever. I don't know if there'd be any reason why they'd need to fly people in on this or whatever. But even still, it's incredibly cool to look at. He's doing it. He's flying this thing. He's steering it. It's all him, and it's wicked fast. And I'll say it again: it's one of the most badass things I've ever seen.
Well, you know who would be using this kind of equipment is James Bond, right? I mean, this is how he's going to get in and out of the evil lair.
Yeah, I could definitely
Bond has
see
done
him
that.
Doing
Bond,
it.
He did that in the late '60s.
Yeah, but not with this kind of thing, though, right?
No.
And in the James Bond movie, though, he'll be flying it for like an hour. You know, won't just last 9 or 10 minutes. But even still, you know, the idea that he designed it and, you know, this is a guy that's definitely working with some money, but at the same time, you know, this is from his elbow grease, and it's very inspiring to see someone, you know, just come up with an idea like this and pull it off and do it so well. And he looks so cool doing it. You know, it's just such an inspiration.
I think the mere idea of him flying beside the jet fighters was brilliant in its own right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It made it cooler.
Yeah.
We're joined now by Reese Morgan. Reese, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me.
How have you been since we talked to you last time?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, I'm good.
So we're having you back on because you got embroiled in another issue. in fact,
can't you stay out of trouble,
yes, young man?
I'm a bit of a troublemaker.
You are a troublemaker. There's no question about it. But Stanislaw Brzezinski, who runs a cancer clinic in Texas, sent his internet pit bull after you, who goes by the name of Mark Stevens. So tell us about that. What happened?
Back in August, I wrote a blog about primarily about the Hope for Laura campaign, which is a campaign to send a UK mother to the Brzezinski Clinic to get her treated with antineoplaston therapy, which is the therapy Brzezinski sells, except he's not legally allowed to sell it just outright. He has to sell it in the form of a clinical trial because... various issues.
Yeah, it's not FDA approved.
No.
But he does have approval for using it as an investigational new drug.
Yeah.
Right.
And he runs it in the weird way of getting people to pay to be part of a clinical trial, which is a little unusual in itself, as normally people get paid to be part of a clinical trial for expenses and costs, or they volunteer to be part of clinical trials. So that's part of the reason that my skepticism sort of came into it, but also because it's a cancer treatment, so, you know. Mm-hmm. But then, I blogged about that in late August, and then that just sort of died away. A couple of months later, I received a lovely email from Mark Stevens telling me to shut down my blog immediately and remove all references to Brzezinski from the internet. I don't know whether he meant all references by me from the internet, because he didn't actually state that, so...
Yeah. Now, you have to scrub it from the entire internet.
Yes, any mention from him. And one rather amusing segment from that was he told me that every single statement I made in the article was false. And I stated in the article that Brzezinski runs the Brzezinski Clinic and offers antineoplaston therapy. So I don't know whether that was meant to be false as well.
Yeah.
But
well, what's interesting is that this guy, Stevens, also was sending threatening letters to other bloggers, including Quackometer, who also wrote an article later after yours about the same topic. And he's trying to come off sounding like a lawyer, but he's not fooling anyone, you know, because he just doesn't have the chops. He's just too dumb to sound convincing as a lawyer. So he says like stupid things like everything you said is false, kind of things that no careful lawyer would ever say, you know.
Course. And I mean, after speaking to Andy Lewis from Quackometer, we did a little bit of research into his IP addresses from the emails, from the headers, and traced him back to California. And I checked with the Texas bar on the website, and he doesn't seem to be registered as a lawyer there. And I checked with the California bar, and he doesn't seem to be registered as a lawyer there. So, yeah, he seems to be acting as a lawyer, but he's not qualified, as far as I can tell, to be a lawyer.
He's not a lawyer. That's the bottom line. So,
Cousin Vinny.
Right. The Brzezinski Clinic did send out a press release on November 29th.
Yes.
In which they admit that they hired this guy as an independent contractor to provide web optimization services and to attempt to stop the dissemination of false and inaccurate information concerning Dr. Brzezinski and the clinic. So they basically admitted that, yeah, they hired this guy to go around intimidating bloggers and trying and demanding that they shut down their blogs. And he was doing it, you know, overtly. I mean, basically, he was making no bones about it. He was saying, I'm going to sue you for libel if you don't shut down your website.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was saying.
Yeah.
And, of course, I don't know exactly what the libel laws are like in America. I think they're a little fairer than they are in the UK.
They're much better. But it still is a pain in the ass. I mean, you don't want to get sued.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course.
It could still be very expensive, even if the lawsuit is frivolous. So your response, you took down your blog post for a while until you could sort out what was going on.
Yeah. Luckily, I know David Alan Green and I know Simon Singh. So I got in touch with them and I spoke to Simon and he put me in touch with his lawyer, Robert Dugans, who helped him with the British Chiropractic Association versus Singh case. And helped him win that case. And so, yeah, he was helping me with legal advice and he helped author the emails that I sent back. And I particularly enjoyed sending that last email because it seemed to have shut Mark Stevens up.
And, what did you say?
It was referencing a lot of cases, such as I think there was a New York Times case. And it was like, if you sue me in the US, I'll rely on the well-known authority of this case and this case and this case.
Yeah.
And but if you sue me in the UK, I'll rely on the authority of these cases. And I then gave Mark Stevens something like another 7 days to get back to me with any with the exact wording that he thought was libelous, and he seemed to disappear.
Yeah.
And then I got another email from a lawyer. Called Dozier Internet Law or something along those lines, who were telling me that they were going to look into it. But I gave them time as well. But no, they've still not got back to me.
Yeah. So yeah. So you got basically a real lawyer to counter their fake lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But now they do have a real lawyer, the Brzezinski Clinic. But they're just saying, oh, we don't know. We're just looking into it. They don't know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's pretty clear that this was just all a deliberate attempt to intimidate critics, hoping that they would shut down because it was more trouble than it was worth. But also, one thing that prompted the press release from the Brzezinski Clinic and further escalated the science blogging backlash against them was that there was some pretty strong threats made against you by Stevens as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was using some really underhand techniques. I mean, he was telling me that if I thought I was as big as Google, that I would face my life in the courts and that sort of thing, because allegedly they sued Google and won a case to get the algorithm changed or affected in some way so that the words quack and fraud wouldn't appear next to his name on the suggested searches, although they still do. So I don't know exactly where he was coming from with that. But yeah, so he seems to have been wrong with that. But then the most worrying thing is he did a Whoist search on my website, which, because I also have a business tech team, which is a tech support business. And legally in the UK, under Nominet laws, who are the ones who register UK domain names, if you're a business, you have to have your home address or your business address, which for me is my home address. And he found this out, and then he started, he got a Google Maps image of my house and sent this to me in, yeah, which was a really quite a weird thing to receive.
I mean, yeah, in my opinion, that is a not even a veiled threat. That's a direct threat. It's like, hey, I know where you live.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was like.
That's what it was. I mean, when you say that to somebody, hey, I know where you live, that is a threat. Mm. That is a threat against your person and or your property, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Brzezinski Clinic essentially distanced themselves from this guy.
Yeah.
Admitting they hired him, but then saying he's no longer represents them, and that, you know, sending you the image of your house was, they didn't know about that, and that, you know, they don't agree with that. They further go on to say that, however, we're still going to try to intimidate bloggers into not criticizing us. And they pick out 3 points that they say their critics are claiming that are false and defamatory. One is that antineoplastons are made from urine, which he says that's false. They're synthesized from chemicals. The blogs that I've read, however, didn't say antineoplastons are currently made from urine. They pointed out that they were first isolated from urine, and that's how they were purified previously. And you can still, you know, you can find there are peptides that are normally excreted in the urine. Brzezinski's correction was actually more misleading than what was being reported in the blogs.
Yeah, it's all a diversion from the main points at hand. It's all a diversion.
It's all a diversion. You're exactly right. And they didn't go at he didn't respond to the actual points that were being made.
Right,
how
right.
come you're still promoting a quote unquote experimental therapy after 34 years?
Mm.
Really, 34 years? You haven't managed to do one decent trial?
I mean, it's. I find it really bad on the part of the FDA, and I'm really concerned about how they're still letting him do these trials after 34 years of it being an investigational drug, if you want to call it that. And yet they're still not making him do an actual good trial on this. If he has got a cure for cancer or cancers, you know, then he has an ethical duty, really, to do a good trial or good trials that show this does actually work. Because otherwise, you know, he is making it look like quackery.
Yes. He's doing it. If it's not quackery, he's doing a damn good job of making it look that way.
Exactly.
You're absolutely correct. But you can't blame the FDA because their hands are tied. The FDA doesn't have as much power as they should have. So they're acting within the law that and within their scope. But it's not their fault that, you know, they're not given the authority that they need to shut this kind of thing down. Also, in the U.S., states are responsible for regulating a lot of the practice of medicine. The FDA also has sent a warning letter to his IRB, the Investigational Review Board, or Institutional Review Board. They're supposed to approve the research, saying that this is ethical and appropriate. And the FDA has cited them on numerous violations. And they have not, as far as I could tell, so far responded or addressed those concerns. So the FDA is pursuing it within the scope of their regulatory power, but it's at the wheels of that process grind slowly. He's still doing these sort of phase two trials, which are unblinded, you know, not well controlled. They're just a little more than glorified case controls, which is anecdotal. Further, the antineoplastons they're waste products that are excreted in the urine. We know what they are. I mean, Saul Green wrote a very good article about it, you know, saying exactly chemically what antineoplastons are. They are known substances. There's no reason to think that they have any cancer-fighting ability, and Brzezinski hasn't presented any evidence that would make anybody think that. Mm. And they're toxic chemicals. He's giving experimental, really poorly researched cancer chemotherapy for 34 years without producing any compelling evidence, And he's charging hundreds of thousands of dollars to do it.
Other than that, he's totally legit.
Yeah, it is astounding. I know it's very frustrating that he has gotten away with this as long as he had. And that is a sad commentary on the ineffective regulations we have in this country, that somebody like him can skate by for this long. It really is sad.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree.
But the good news is that there are brave bloggers out there like you, Reese, who are not going to back down, who are going to call it what it is. And it was really nice to see. You know, he really did, you know, he did sick his attack dog on you. And when he found out that you were a high school student, it seemed like he went after you all the more.
And he became all the more patronizing while he did so. I mean, the thing about web optimization is that if he was going to do any sort of SEO, like search engine optimization, which he didn't really need to, because, I mean, when you search Brzezinski, the first results are all positive at Brzezinski Clinic and all that. So there wasn't any need for that sort of web optimization. So the only other thing it could have been was silencing critics.
Let me do a search on him right now. Brzezinski. Yeah, fraud is number 4 suggested, and quack is the number 6 suggested, and scam is the number 7 suggested completion. But let me just put his name in. Well, it's first page, you get the Quack Watch takedown of him. So it is mostly positive, the first page. But there are, and your blog post is first page.
Oh, now. Right.
That's what he accomplished by this, you know. So this is the Streisand effect.
Exactly.
You know, so now he has the entire science blogging community calling him a quack. And your blog is now on the first page of Google hits when you look up Brzezinski.
It's only appropriate as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. That's good work, boys. All right, so Reese, so who are you going to piss off next?
I don't know. I mean, I've done Jim Humble, who is a bit more incompetent than Brzezinski. But Brzezinski seems to be more established than Jim Humble. So I don't know. I'm going to have to have a look.
Okay. Well, and feel free to coordinate with us, you know, next time. We'll do the 1-2.
Okay, brilliant.
All right, Reese, thanks for joining us
again. No problem. Thanks for having me again.
All right, good night.
Thanks, Reese. Night.
Evan.
Hey, Doc.
So tell us about Who's That Noisy? I'm very interested to learn what last week's noise was.
I must play it once again for yourself and the audience to be reminded of last week's Who's That Noisy? Now, do you kind of detect a pattern, a little rhythm kind of?
Yeah, it sounds like Asia. Maybe a little Europe.
It sounds like Asia.
Interesting, Steve.
A little Europe thrown in there.
Very interesting. Keep going.
Maybe some North America.
Yes, yes.
Kind of put it all together.
Put it all together, and what do you have? The Earth to Disk Project.
The Earth to Disk Project. Very interesting.
Yeah.
What's that?
What they did is they created a 12-inch record, okay? So what you're hearing is the spinning of the record, the needle going around. And what it's doing is there are these pits and heights to the actual vinyl itself that represent the globe, the northern hemisphere in this case, transposed onto that disc, right? So as you're going around, you're hitting the oceans. When you're hitting the land, that's kind of where you're hearing those noises as it keeps going around and around. If you actually look at the disc itself, you can actually see the continents of North America, clear as a bell, on the disc itself. A standard turntable will read the relief, and the chain of elevation data crossed during the playing is directly transposed into audible sound vibrations, and that is what you're hearing.
Cool. Yeah, so the two pauses are the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, basically, and the shorter noise is North America, and the longer one is Europe and Asia.
That's right.
Yeah.
Neat.
So this was a very, very cool noisy sent to us by a listener.
Heath. Joe Bag of Donuts.
No. Heath Sato from Los Angeles, California, provided us with last week's noisy. So thank you, Heath.
Did anybody get that right?
Nobody got that right.
So Keith wins.
Very good, Keith. That was a good one.
Good
that was
job,
a difficult
Keith.
One.
What do you got for this week?
Okay. I'm just going to play a little brief Who's That Noisy this week. But I have a feeling that Some of our listeners are going to get this. Here we go.
Behind.
There's a lot of guys, and I've debated that one guy, that Phil Plait from Battleship. I clown that guy.
That's it. That's all you get.
Interesting, Evan. Yeah, I do. I agree. I think that there's maybe one or two people who get the context there.
Yeah.
And Phil Plait is not allowed to answer who's that noisy this week.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Phil.
I agree. You're out.
We're going to just do one quick email this week. This one comes from Alan Evil from Louisville, Kentucky.
Evil.
And Alan writes, since I was a child, my family had canned organic tomato juice made by putting organic tomatoes, and then in parentheses, I don't care what you say, organic has better flavor than chemically fertilized tomatoes, through a hand-cranked juicer, adding only salt, pouring the juice into clear glass jars, and then canning them in a water bath or pressure cooker. I have a jar in my cupboard right now that was canned in 2009, and it is still bright red. Could you clarify the statement that tomato juice is actually brown and is colored red? My actual experience with it contradicts what was said on the podcast. Rebecca, explain yourself.
I lied. I just like lying. Yeah, I heard from someone on Twitter who works at Heinz, and he said that there are a lot of different companies that make tomato juice, but at his, they didn't add any food coloring. And this surprised me, not because it was something that I just assumed was true, but because I read it in a scientific study. And so I was relying on that without looking into it any further. So I apologize. I accepted the word of a group of scientists, instead of looking it up for myself. And apparently this can depend on how you preserve the tomatoes, like how you can them. But apparently there is a way to can them in such a way that preserves the red color. Steve, you also looked into this a bit.
Yeah,
right?
I found the study that led you astray called Why We Prefer Certain Colors, and the author, Douglas Fields, writes that...
Damn you, Doug.
Yeah, that he writes, would you drink brown tomato juice? If given a choice, most likely you would refuse the brown tomato juice in favor of the same stuff doped with an artificial chemical that stains the juice bright red. So he was using that as an example of how color affects our perception of food, and he probably didn't source that very well, and he passed it along, and so that's why you accepted it. But I also just, independently just looking at tomato juice said, well, what do they put in? What are the ingredients in tomato juice? I found a site that had listed the ingredients for the top 10 tomato juices. And it has a category of coloring. Of the top 10, three list nothing as artificial colors. Five of them list vitamin C apparently makes tomato juice brighter red. And two of them have carrot juice listed as providing the extra red color. But no, like, food coloring. So it is all just vitamin C, tomato juice, and carrot juice.
No artificial food coloring.
Yeah, no artificial food coloring, right.
Apologies.
So there you go. It's always more complicated than you think.
Sorry to all the canners out there.
Yep.
There's a lot of you.
Right, right.
A lot more of you than we thought.
A lot of tomato cans out there.
I'm a little relieved.
Yeah, Jay, you were horrified about the red.
You were really horrified by that.
Now, I like tomatoes and tomato juice, and
I'm gonna get a list of your favorite foods from one of your brothers, and I'm gonna find out which one is the ugliest looking without food coloring.
Jay, you don't eat margarine, do you?
No, but I know all about it. You know what the most horrifying thing I've seen so far food-wise, other than like people
Jell-O.
Eating insects or, shit
insects
like
aren't
that.
Bad.
Jell-O.
Yeah, what's wrong?
How about excreted coffee beans?
Oh, civet coffee.
Did you ever see what they make chicken nuggets out
chickens?
Of?
Raccoon, tree bark.
The lips and anuses, I believe.
Maggots.
It's everything that isn't considered like meat on the chicken, meaning like they take the breast meat and the dark meat off. It's the bones and all the connective tissue and all the fat and all that stuff. And then they pulverize it to the point where it's like a putty type thing, right? And it comes out and it's literally like exactly what you think it would look like. It's like this fleshy pink like situation. And then like they have to do all sorts of nasty stuff to it to like bleach it and to like get rid of the nasty flavor and like bombard it with flavoring and oh my god, like
it gets
don't
washed
eat
in
chicken.
It gets washed in ammonia because of all of the bacteria that's in it.
At least it's clean.
And then it gets reflavored artificially. And then it gets dyed because it's pink.
We correct one misstatement and you guys want to go right into another one.
That's not a misstatement.
Steve, I didn't make that up.
They don't grind up the bones and the eyeballs and the other stuff, Jay. It's they take a whole chicken and they basically sieve out all of the meat. But it does get all the edible tissue, which does include things like tendons. But it doesn't include...
Right, it's not bones.
It's not the bones and it's or the beak or any of the other stuff.
Look at that. Look at it, though. Look at that picture. It's all right.
You
okay,
get this, you
know,
get this,
I,
this pink. It,
oh.
It is completely ground up, so it has that texture. That's why I don't like those chicken nuggets because it has.
It's a paste.
It has that pasty
chicken paste
texture. I agree with that. I only like the ones that are actual that actually have the texture of actual meat.
You should call it Soylent Beige or something.
Yeah, Soylent Chicken.
Soylent Pink.
Soylent Pink is chicken. Pink is chicken. We are joined now by James, the amazing Randy. Randy, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
It's been a while, Steve. You know it.
I know we don't have you on enough.
Yeah, there you go. I feel neglected. I just sit in the corner and wait for you to call and wait for you to call.
Randy, what have you been up to?
Yeah, well, I did a tour in Canada. I did 9 cities in 9 days, and that's not exactly the kind of thing that agrees me with me very well. I was up in the morning running for the airport, pushing the media aside, getting onto a plane, landing a couple of hours later in another part of Canada, and going to the auditorium, setting it up, and then handling the press again, taking a bite to eat, doing the talk, falling into bed, and doing the same thing the next morning. And it's just incredible. But I managed it very well, and we got a huge reaction. We had turn-away crowds at every one of the 9 stops.
So, yeah, you're still a workhorse for the skeptical movement.
Oh, well, yes. Well, maybe a work pony, you know, but doing okay.
So we're talking to you at this time of the year, though, because the JREF is promoting their Season of Reason. Mm-hmm. I got your lovely email promoting that. So tell us about that. What's going on with the JREF?
Well, at the end of the year, of course, the whole Season to Reason thing sort of comes into focus. And not only that, people at the end of the year are often thinking of something they can do to help the taxes for the next year. And they know about the fact that we are a not-for-profit organization and we're tax-deductible. That makes them appear in a little more giving mood than normally. I don't know that they happily sign the check, but they do with enthusiasm. I get really wonderful mail at about this time of the year from people who are saying that that they look forward to this opportunity. And I've actually created, well, I haven't created, but we have created a collectible item. This year it's Skepticlaus. That's me, as you might have guessed. And these are handmade 3-inch diameter ceramic holiday ornaments and made by a company called Surly Ramix, who supply them to us. And it's the 2011 Season of Reason ornament you can hang on your tree if you still have a tree. How many of you guys actually still have trees?
Oh, we do.
Oh, yeah. Evan, you're Jewish.
My wife is not, though, and we have the nice fake tree that goes up every year. It's very, very easy.
Yeah, and whatever. I'm atheist, and I have
a
tree.
It's a holiday tree, yeah.
Well, I think it could be called a Hanukkah bush.
There you go.
Yeah, let's do that.
It's all pagan anyway. It's not like the,
yeah.
The,
oh, yeah.
The,
oh,
the
yeah,
seasonal tree was a Christian tradition. It was a pagan tradition.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And I have often thought of calling Christmas Newtonmas. You know, it doesn't quite come to the tongue easily, but Isaac Newton, after all, shares the birthday, and I would sort of like to see it more dedicated to Isaac Newton. He's dead now, I understand. I knew him well, as you know.
Yeah.
Good old Jim Newton, yep.
Great man. A little nutty in some ways because he believed in all kinds of things. Astrology was a favorite delusion of his, but I guess we can forgive him some faux pas.
He had that whole alchemy thing going there.
So, Randy, you didn't finish your original thought. Now, you guys are asking for donations for these Christmas ornaments. Is that what's happening?
Yeah. And there are other ways that you can contribute as well. It's not just a case of sending us money or anything, like connecting with the JREF online to take action against these scam products that we're all very well aware of, or just keeping your friends informed. The more of an image that the JREF can generate, especially at this particular season, the better, of course. We've done very, very well in this last year. I mean, we took people like James von Prague to the stake, so to speak, and we started to ignite the faggots, and they didn't quite work. Somebody blew them out. But we certainly threatened this guy, and we challenged him. And DJ's stunt, which he announced to me on a day when I was not very receptive of new ideas like that, of getting zombies to visit one of his sessions. That cool. turned out to be a huge success. At first I thought, oh, this is going to backfire on us somehow. But it was a huge success because we got all kinds of attention on major television programs across the country and across the world. So we made a big splash with that. The idea was that James von Prague only speaks to dead people. And so I must admit we made them up. They weren't really dead people.
They were fake dead people?
That's right, yes. They were just mildly ill.
Mostly dead.
But, yeah.
Not quite yet.
They got better.
Certainly from the neck up, yes. And this is a sort of a new thing for the JREF because we didn't previously target individuals. I mean, Uri Geller popped up so often in the shooting gallery that he was automatically popped down as soon as he put his head in there. But we didn't specify people and go after them specifically. But we are doing more of that now, and we've got Sylvia Brown in our sights, too, and there's lots to put in your sight if you've seen her lately. She looks like Jabba the Hutt with long nails.
Now, wait a minute. Wait. We're insulting Jabba here.
I apologize to Star Wars. Yeah, I really do. I apologize. Sorry, Jabba. He's never been a close friend of mine, but I have to apologize. But we had over 4.5 million people watch us take down paranormal scams and put psychics to test on ABC's primetime Nightline, Beyond Belief it was called. And they cooperated with us very nicely there, and they didn't have to exaggerate anything. It was simply a case of James von Prague went down the basin, let's say. He just went down all by himself, and he's made new rules now for his public meetings that he charges something like $300 to attend, just to sit in a seat and listen to him carry on. Can you imagine? He's got new rules now where he can filter out people, and he's got security people all over the place because maybe he doesn't want zombies around. And I guess we scared him a bit, and that's fine. Keep him on the run all the time.
But he's still ducking the challenge.
Oh, yeah. No, he won't. He won't touch the challenge. He has refused to answer any correspondence. And when people in the media ask him about it, he just says that's something he doesn't prefer to talk about. And they let him go. I don't know why they should be pressing him on this sort of thing. Because if he can talk to dead people, we will pay him $1 million. Now, that seems to be a rather attractive offer. All you have to do is prove that what you claim is true, and he should be able to prove that very easily in a simple test, and we give him $1 million. Now, what's not to like about that offer?
So, Randy, the JREF really has been very busy. I mean, they've been greatly expanding the kind of projects that they're doing, you know, sponsoring a 1023 anti-homeopathy campaign. Mm-hmm. Science-based medicine support that I'm helping them with. Doing, you know, revitalizing the million-dollar challenge. And if you go on to the I'm on the Season of Reason website right now, where you have a list of all the things that the JREF has been doing. Mm-hmm. So it definitely is a good time to support the skepticism, to support the JREF. And can you tell us any preview of what's in store for TAM 10?
I don't know very much about it, Frankie. They try to keep me out of this sort of thing because I'm so old, you see. But the next ham will be held in Las Vegas July 12 to 15. That's finally been decided upon. And I can't talk about two headliners that we've got lined up. I'm told not to mention it, so my lips are sealed and I can't speak about it. But all I can say is that Cosmos is coming up again, you know, under Neil deGrasse Tyson. Oh, did I say that?
Yeah. Having absolutely nothing to do with the previous topic.
No, not at all, of course. But, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson has been very cooperative with us, though, folks. I must say, he's a charmer. He draws people just from all over the place, and people are just in awe of the man. I am, too, to be quite frank with you.
All right, Randy, it's great talking to you, as always.
Thank you so much, Steve. And
Randy, I hear there's a chance that you might make it to Nexus in April.
Yes, I believe so. I'm certainly working on it. I'll be able to make an announcement on that pretty soon. And we'll talk to you again soon, Steve. Let's not leave it so long next time.
No, absolutely. Good talking with you, Randy.
Thanks, Randy.
Okay. Night, Randy.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. Is everybody ready for this week?
Yeah.
Ready.
Indubitably.
Okay. I always give these in a random order.
Mm-hmm.
Determined.
I understand.
You don't. Determined by a manual.
Three-sided die?
Yeah. I use a six-sided die because I don't have a three-sided die.
That would be impossible.
It's not really random enough, don't you think?
It's a sufficient randomizer.
Well.
Well, here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that endoscopic surgeons perform better when music is playing in the surgical suite. Item number two. New research finds that anti-atheist sentiment among believers is based largely on distrust, with atheists being considered among the most untrustworthy, comparable to rapists. Item number three, psychological studies find that more creative people have an increased tendency to cheat. Evan, go first.
Well, endoscopic surgeons performing better when music is playing in the surgical suite. Now, let's think about that. Why would that possibly be? Maybe if the music acts as a means of getting into your own little surgical rhythm. You know, it depends maybe on what kind of surgery it is, if it's something that's not too complex and well practiced by lots of different surgeons, there could be a routine to it, right? So if the music's kind of playing and offering a kind of a beat to go to, for lack of a better term, then perhaps that is true. So the next one about the research finding anti-atheist sentiment among believers based largely on distrust. It's a little harsh. The last one about psychological studies finding more creative people have an increased tendency to cheat. So is a tendency to cheat kind of a byproduct of looking at creative solutions to problems? It could very well be. Maybe it shows up as a tendency to cheat. Maybe perhaps they're even an unaware to a certain degree that they might be cheating, yet they are just looking for an edge. Their mind is working a lot of different directions, and this is one of the vectors. So I'm going to say that one's true. That leaves me with the anti-atheist sentiment among believers based largely on distrust. I'm going to have to say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
The endoscopic surgeons. I'm not sure why this would have singled out endoscopic surgery. The only thing I really got to say is that I could see the music being distracting and potentially losing focus. Let's see, the anti-atheist sentiment, I mean, that totally makes sense to me. I know that atheists are probably the most reviled minority on the planet, and distrust sounds reasonable to me because I think a lot of people would think of atheists as hedonists that are just out for themselves because, you know, there's no afterlife and have as much fun and run rampant and rape and pillage as much as you can. I could see how that would foster distrust. The more the creative people having a tendency to cheat, I agree with Evan's assessment of that, that creative people would tend to think more outside the box and at least consider using cheating as an option. You know, it's not to say that creative people are damn cheaters, but just maybe just a little bit of an increased tendency. The only one that's really rubbed me the wrong way, and I can't really even say why, is the endoscopic surgeon one. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay?
The one about the endoscopic surgeons performing better with music playing in the background. My first question is, I don't know why it would be that kind of surgeon over other types of surgeons. I mean, I could see music playing in the background helping in a few ways. I mean, I usually turn music on at work when I have something tedious to do, and that helps. It helps me keep going. It also helps me kind of relax. And I think, if I remember correctly, because I've read about this before, I think it might have something to do with putting the surgeon at ease. The next one about anti-atheist sentiment, that's interesting. I mean, I could definitely see people that believe, that have some type of faith when they think about people that don't believe in God. Typically, it's like, you know, they're considered to be the scum of the earth. I mean, it's a pretty, still today, it's even a very, very negative thing. So, I mean, I could see that. Sure. There's no reason not to believe that. And the last one about the psychological studies saying that creative people have an increased tendency to cheat. I definitely find that one interesting as well, thinking about why would, if that's true, what would make that happen? And I think part of it could be explained about, you know, I agree with the guys that they have, they're thinking out of the box and there's more of a ability for them to maybe justify what's going on. Out of those three, though, I mean, I could see them all being true. I'll say the one about the atheists is the fake. I'm agreeing with somebody. I can't remember now.
Right, Rebecca?
Okay, well, that's the one that I found the most believable because we've seen studies, you know, again and again and again that show that atheists are the least liked group of people, you know. But the one that I'm thinking of that's most relevant is the one that showed, the survey that showed that people were least likely to vote for an atheist for president when you include other marginalized groups like various religions and races and
would
genders.
They vote for rapists?
Rapists, I don't think were included in the presidential thing, but if they were, I bet that atheists would hover somewhere around rapists. And when you're talking about who you would want to be your president, you're not just talking about likability, although that's a huge part of it, but you're also talking about trustworthiness. So yeah, I can totally see how atheists would come in last place along with rapists in terms of trustworthiness. Music helping surgeons perform better, that I'm not sure about. I feel like in most other cases, when you're talking about people doing intensive tasks, music is a distraction. It can be really soothing for some people, but it doesn't necessarily help concentration. So that one is suspect. And creative people have an increased tendency to cheat. I'm also not sure about that, but Evan made a really good point about how people who are creative could find creative ways to solve a problem, even if it defies ethical boundaries. So I'm going to go with the surgery one as being the fake.
Okay. So you guys are split between one and two. That means you all agree that psychological studies find that more creative people have an increased tendency to cheat is science. And that one is science.
Hooray.
So you're all
boo for cheating. Hooray for us.
We're all safe so far.
Cheaters never win.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a psychological study. They, you know, they had to put the subjects into an artificial situation, giving them an opportunity to cheat. And well, you know, we'll link to the article so you get the full description. But essentially, they gave their subjects a task, and they were going to pay them based upon how well they did. And they gave the subjects an opportunity to cheat. And those who scored more highly on tests of creativity, significantly more often than people who scored lowly on those tests, cheated. They actually took the opportunity and cheated. These studies did not explore the reason why there was increased cheating. The speculations were actually very similar to what you guys were saying. It seemed that the most significant hypothesis was that those people who are creative are better able to rationalize away their behavior. They're more creative at thinking up rationalizations. Wow. So whereas people who are less creative would just go along with the flow because they can't talk themselves into, you know, doing what they want to do or what they know is wrong. So let's go to number one. A new study finds that endoscopic surgeons perform better when music is playing in the surgical suite. Bob and Rebecca think that this one is the fiction. Jay and Evan think that this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Hooray! Yeah.
High
five, Bob.
High five, everyone. Yeah.
Wow, terrible
high
five.
I'm jumping in on this. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, that one is, I made that up. That is based on real research, however, that shows that endoscopic surgeons perform better when they're trained to mimic the eye movements of more experienced endoscopic surgeons, which is odd.
Really?
It's a little odd. And I'm not sure I 100% buy the results of this study, meaning that I think it's easy for it to be artifactual in some way. But taking that face value, what they did was they sort of tracked the eye movements of experienced endoscopic surgeons, and then they had, you know, different groups of students, medical students, studying how to do the same procedure, and they had one group actually deliberately mimic the tracking, the eye movements that the more experienced surgeons made, and they developed their skills more quickly and better, you know, than the other group. Here's my real problem with it. It seems like a really strange top-down way of training, that I would think that the way the experienced surgeons move their eyes is a reflection of their understanding of what's going on. You know, they've developed experience and instinct for what they need to be looking at and what procedure they need to go through, and that the eye movements are just a consequence of that. And, you know, bypassing the actual underlying knowledge and skill and just mimicking the eye movements, I don't see how that would be a good method, but this study showed that it was advantageous. So I just find the results odd. I'm not sure I understand them, which is why I wouldn't really buy it until I saw, you know, see that it's replicated at least. But that was interesting. That was an interesting result. But nothing to do with music playing in the background. And I looked for any studies looking at endoscopic surgery and music, and I couldn't find any. So I think that's, you know, I don't think I inadvertently hit upon something that's true. I think that's complete fiction. Yeah, and then number two, new research finds that anti-atheist sentiment among believers is based largely on distrust, with atheists being considered among the most untrustworthy, comparable to rapists, is science. Everything that you guys were saying is true in terms of atheists being considered, you know, generally a very disliked group.
Wicked.
Among believers. And less than 40% of Americans said they would vote for an atheist candidate for office. Less than 40%. That's pretty bad. Lower than, as Rebecca said, other minorities.
I'll bet you in context, though, that number is decent compared to maybe 100 years ago. You probably get 5% of people.
So this is a series of studies, and they were trying to explore why that is, why it is that atheists are treated that way. And what they found was generally that believers don't dislike atheists necessarily. They just distrust them, and that they really would only discriminate against them in high trust domains like office. And although the research didn't explore this specifically, the thinking is that people who are religious feel that belief in God keeps people honest. And that therefore somebody, like, I think Bob, you made this point. If you don't believe in God, therefore there's nothing to keep you from behaving badly or cheating. They have no reason to trust you, which I think is sort of the common experience as well. That's what people say, you know, if you ask them about their feelings of atheists. Like when I've had that conversation with believers, they seem surprised that you wouldn't just be completely hedonistic. What's keeping you from just
acting out your,
from being completely amoral? It's like, morals?
False dichotomy.
Ethics? How would you act if you didn't believe in God? Do you think that without that belief you would be running around raping and pillaging? I mean, it's I just don't think they think it through. But I do think it's just basic human psychology. You know, this notion of even though we may not act our this way ourselves, the we do have an innate sense of justice and punishment. We feel that people who do things that are wrong should be punished. In fact, there was recent research which suggests that children as young as 8 months old know that people who do bad things should be punished. It seems to suggest it really is something that we're born with. And, you know, religious belief often provides a system of ultimate justice, you know. So we evolved as social creatures. We need that to feel that society works, that people will behave. So it's not surprising that that's sort of built into the psychology of belief.
So good job, me and Bob.
So yeah,
yeah, good job, guys. Good job. High five.
You're so smart, Rebecca.
No, you are.
Right. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
This was a quote sent in by a listener named Tracy Myers, and it is part of a speech for Richard Nixon that he never said, written by the famous William Sapphire. And the quote is, "In ancient days, men looked at stars and saw their heroes in the constellations. In modern times, we do much the same, but our heroes are epic men and women of flesh and blood." William Sapphire!
Now, that's an interesting quote, though it was never said, then how did it come to light? It was, I guess, just the written speech was made available at some point, I assume?
I think it was a contingency speech.
Okay.
Which I think means if they died or crashed. The Apollo 11 missions, I think it was revolving around.
Oh, do they do that? They have to have for any bad thing that could happen or any result, they have to have a contingency speech ready to go.
Yeah, they can't have them go, oh, I thought everything was going to work out great. So they, you know,
you have nothing ready to say. Can you imagine, imagine your job is writing speeches that are never going to be said?
Writing, the other speech. The one that never
the
makes
chances
it.
are not going to get used.
I have a few announcements. First, I mentioned this last week. I'll say it again. We uploaded the two videos that the SGU produced this year are now on our YouTube channel, and you can go to that channel by going to www.youtube.com/user/theskepticsguide. And you can see the top two videos in the right-hand column are the new ones that I did, and I'd really appreciate it.
True Fellas and the SGU 24 show intro, both of which are pretty funny. Mm-hmm.
And leave your feedback. Thank you for that. Another quick thing is, if I promised anybody anything that I didn't do, let me know. Okay, I know that sounds vague, but I think I owe a couple of people voiceovers. I know one guy definitely from Tam, and I've been so busy, and I'm reconciling the year 2011. So if I owe you a T-shirt for any reason, or if I owe you voiceovers or anything, just email me. At the info@theskepticsguide.org.
Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Shirley.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.
Randy, most of us aren't going to say anything. We're just going to listen to you talk and tell us about Santa Claus.
Well, I was born at a very early age in a log cabin I helped my father build. We were very poor and couldn't afford kids, so the people next door had me. It was even cheaper, you know. My brother, well, he got sent over from Japan in an envelope. It's a long story, but I don't want to get into that.
It's a coming-of-age story.
Yes, all those things, yes.